Genesis 35, we take a trip from Bethel to Bethlehem tonight. Remember last week, there was the tragic episode of two of Jacob's sons wreaking vengeance on the village of Shechem. Now, the aftermath, first, verses 1 to 4, the command to forsake idols. It says, then God said to Jacob, arise, go to Bethel. And you remember he had been to Bethel many years earlier when he was leaving Canaan. Now he's back in Canaan. Go back to Bethel. He had previously had a dream of a ladder and angels on it and dedicated himself to God. Now he's to rededicate himself with this altar. It says, go to Bethel, dwell there, make an altar to God who appeared to you earlier. And so he rededicates himself and his family. Verse 2, Jacob said to his household and all that were with him, put away the foreign gods who are among you. Purify yourself. Change your garments. So he rededicated not only himself, but his family. And that's something that a father should take the lead in. And specifically says, put away the idols. What idols? Well, you remember when they left Mesopotamia, Rachel brought some of her father's idols. Maybe she still had them. In the previous chapter, two of the sons had plundered the idolaters, so maybe they captured and saved some of the idols. So he said, get rid of them all. And it says here, put on clean clothes, which back then would have been symbolic of dedication and cleansing. Perhaps also take away any pagan clothing that you had stolen from the village of Shechem. And so there's this rededication. It says, let us arise, go to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God. Verse 3, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me. So he remembers, and so should we. We should remember our previous dedication, God's promises, and God's protection. Remember all of God's blessings. When we forget, we get afraid, we wander into doubt, so let us remember. Like Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me. Remember what God has done in the past. And then he says, take these gods, verse 4, and bury them. Why bury them instead of burn them? Well, bury them as if to say, don't dedicate them to the use of the one true God. Some people do that with something from their previous life. They say, well, I can use this for God. Well, maybe some things, but some things need to be burned, buried, thrown away, or whatever. Not even sold, just buried, and don't have anything to do with it. So that's what he says. Notice what he said. The foreign gods, the earrings. That's not saying earrings and things like that are wrong, but these would have been ones that were used with pagan symbols on them. And so now have done with them. Verses 5 to 8, now back to Bethel. Verse 5, they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. Previous chapter had ended where Jacob was afraid that other Canaanite villages were going to come after him because of what his sons did. Now it says that as they travel, Canaanites were afraid of Jacob and his traveling family, so they stayed back. There's a couple of lessons in this. There's a parallel in the book of Judges where the Midianites outnumbered Gideon and his people. And then God said, go into the camp at night and listen to them. And he found out they were more afraid of him than he was of them. They were having nightmares about them. Lesson for us is we might be afraid of the world, but they're afraid of us. They've got us outnumbered. But people we know, they're afraid we're going to witness to them or something about our life. So they're kind of skittish about us. Remember when the Israelites went into Canaan hundreds of years later, in the time of Joshua, they go to Rahab and she says, they're all afraid of you. They've heard what your God did at the Red Sea. So think of that today. You might be afraid to witness to someone. They're more afraid you are going to witness to them. So off they go toward Bethel. Verse 6, they came to Luz, that is Bethel. You say, well, where is Luz? Luz is not the same as Uz, where Job lived, but it's also named Bethel in the land of Canaan, he and all the people that were with him. Why not stay in Mesopotamia? Because God had said, this is the promised land. Even though they were greatly outnumbered by the evil Canaanites, Lesson 5 says, Lord, when you save me, why don't you take me straight to heaven? God says, I'll keep you here on earth a little bit longer, surrounded by unbelievers. And he has different purposes for that. Verse 7, he built an altar there, as God had told him. Now, don't just take that for granted. God said, build an altar when you get there, and he did. We should obey God's commandments so that you look back and say, you know, God told me to do this, and by his grace, I did obey his commandment. And he rededicates himself as well. And then out of nowhere, verse 8 just is thrown in here. Deborah, his mother, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried there at Bethel. So we're not told about Rebekah's passing, well, later told about Isaac, but this is the first of three deaths in this chapter. If you read between the lines, it implies Rebekah was elderly, and she had passed away, and her faithful lady-in-waiting, her maidservant that had been with her for many, many years, she now also passed away. This would have touched Jacob because she was the nursemaid that helped raise Jacob when he was a little boy, and also Esau. And so when the mother died, evidently Rebekah came to live with Jacob's family, and now she passes away, and I'm sure this was a sad time, so she was now buried. And it was a sad time for him. Verses 9 to 15 now, God changes Jacob's name to Israel. Appears to him again, verse 9, in either a vision or a dream. It says, when he came from Paddan Aram, and he blessed him. That's a general term. He just blessed him. We're not told exactly how. More camels, good health, a sense of God's nearness. Think of that when you say, Lord, bless me. Can you be more specific? Bless him. How? Sometimes it's just a general thing. Show goodness to him. That's what happened here. So God now blesses him by changing his name. He said, well, what if he did want his name changed? Well, his name was Jacob, which meant deceiver. And I bet he was glad to have his name changed. Occasionally you hear about someone that changes his name, such as if you have a name and then someone else with the same name becomes notorious. Some people then they start using their initials, or they change their name because they say, I don't want to be identified with that and go through the rest of my life. People such and such. So sometimes people change their names. But God changed his name from deceiver to Israel, which means he will rule as God, or this means he's a prince. So that's an elevated name. That's an honor, Israel. And you're reading the rest of the Old Testament, even a few times in the New Testament, the name was also given to his family. They didn't talk about the people as Abraham or as Isaac, but sometimes as Jacob and sometimes as Israel. It goes back to this time here. So what a blessing. I would like to have seen the expression on Jacob's face. Prince, how about that? Hey, Leah, you can call me Prince. And she'll say, I'll just call you Jacob. Well, sometimes God reverted back to calling him Jacob. God changed Simon's name to Peter, but you remember a couple of times he reverts back and calls him Peter, like you're acting like your old person. And then it says, verse 11, God says, I am God Almighty. You remember that was the term El Shaddai that God had used with Abraham and the different names in the book of Genesis. So he reminds them, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. We've seen that several times. And God said it to Abraham, and he had just a couple of children, more with the second wife than with the first. Same thing with Isaac. But now God's keeping the promise to multiply the people, as it says there in verse 11. With Jacob, he's got 11 sons, one daughter later in the chapter, a 12th son. And so be fruitful and multiply, like Genesis 1. And I've mentioned that in this series before. God commands a couple to have children. But unlike this verse, God doesn't promise every couple will have a big family. Some no children, some just one. We were talking just a few minutes ago, John Wesley, the oldest of 19 children. And that woman in Russia that is alleged to have had 69 children. Well, it stopped with just 12 boys and one girl with Jacob. But God kept his promise. Be fruitful and multiply, and I will multiply you. Not only that, he repeats the promise that he had given to Abraham and Isaac. Now it's passed on down, verse 12. The land which I gave to them, I give to you, to your descendants after you, I give this land. Now this is the only specific land grant God has ever given to anybody. We looked at that earlier. How do you determine who owns the land? You say, well, I own the title deed. Well, they're still fighting in different parts of the world over land that, you know, the Jews say the land of Israel belongs to us. The Palestinians say it belongs to us. We were here before you. And they say, well, we were here before you and God gave it to us. So there's always these squabbles about the land. And it's hard to determine who owns. Is it whoever's there, possession 9/10 of the law? But this was the only specific land grant that God gave anybody. God didn't say to the Pilgrim Fathers or to those that settled at Jamestown, this whole continent is yours. And then you had manifest destiny. And sadly, so many of the pioneers moving west took land away from the Indians. So how do you determine who owns land? Do you give it back to the Indians or the Palestinians or what? And then the question arises, and I won't get into it, is this specific land grant still valid today for Israel, or was that contingent upon them believing in the one true God, upholding the covenant, believing in the Messiah, or not? It is interesting that it's repeated over and over again in the Old Testament, but you don't find it in the New Testament. If you can find it, please show it to me where it says this land still belongs to Israel. But it raises a number of other questions about the covenants. But he does say it to him and to his descendants, and so it would be his children, grandchildren, and then the nation would grow and grow and grow. Only specific land grant. And then this appearance of God disappears. Verse 13, God went up from him. Evidently this was a theophany, something that he saw now going up. When God appeared to Gideon, he went up in a flame of fire. Of course, Jesus went up in the ascension. And so there's evidently something visible and audible moving up, and Jacob saw it. We don't know exactly what he saw, but God did hear go up. Verse 14, he set up a pillar in the place where he had talked with him, a pillar of stone. It's kind of like an altar. Later we'll see a tombstone, but he sets up this pillar. Other places they put a pile of rocks. And, they didn't have some of the great monuments and mausoleums that later people did. So he sets up this pillar and he dedicates himself in it to God by pouring a drink offering on it and also oil. Significance of that is found later in the book of Leviticus, where they would offer a certain drinks like wine, and they'd pour it out. Remember when those men went into Bethlehem and brought water from the well to David, it says he poured it out as the thank offering. So this was a thank offering and a rededication offering with this stone. Now we should dedicate ourselves to God. And sometimes people say, I drive a stake in the ground or I go back to a certain place. But in any case, we need to continually rededicate ourselves. This section ends in verse 15. Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him Bethel. It had been named like that before, so he remembers that. No longer Luz, it's Bethel, the house of God. 16 to 20, the death of Rachel, the second death in this chapter. So he moves on from Bethel, just like us. We're pilgrims in a foreign land. Keep on moving, keep on going. And from there, just a little distance to Ephrath, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had hard labor. And they moved on, and so should we. But now Rachel, his favorite wife, is having their second child. She had already had Joseph, and now she's having another son with not just birth pains, which are normal, but here, especially difficult ones, life-threatening ones. That sometimes happens. But fortunately, she had a midwife handy, verse 17. Remember, they didn't have hospitals back then, not many medications. And it says that when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said to her, do not fear, you will have this son also. So she tried to comfort her. You know, a lot of cultures, they rely upon midwives. Phone for the midwife or send a runner to the next village. They don't have doctors. And sometimes a woman just has the baby by herself. But thank God, I don't know if anybody know a midwife. We had a godly midwife at a church I attended before. Very godly. And she would be like this, you know, don't fear, I'm here to help out. And she'd studied midwifery at a nurse's college. And she'd say, oh, I've delivered many babies like this. Now, if she sensed it was going to be a hard labor, they'd say, well, let's go to the hospital. Just don't take any chances. So there was this midwife. And she's trying to comfort her as well as to help her. Says, you will have this son also. And she did. But she also died. Verse 19. So it was as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni, but the father called him Benjamin. Fewer today die in childbirth than in centuries past, but it still sometimes happens. And sadly, when the mother dies and the child survives, sometimes the father later blames that child. That's sad. Child, it wasn't his fault, but sometimes the father associates the grief. But what we see here is one coming into the world, another one leaving the world. And the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. And another little irony. You remember years earlier when Leah and the maids were having all the children, Rachel grabs Jacob, give me children or I die. Well, now she's about to have a child, and she dies, and the child is born. So that was an ironic fulfillment of her demand. And so it says here, her spirit was departing, and she died. Again, put yourself in Jacob's place. Happy because of the baby, sad because he lost his wife. Have you ever been in a situation where you have two very strong emotions at the same time? And it's kind of hard to explain, but we've all been there. For example, look it up in Matthew 28. When the women met Jesus on the road after he rose from the dead, it says they worshiped him with fear and great joy. We usually don't associate those two emotions. We need to have a holy emotions, but sometimes we just have natural emotions like Jacob here. Happy and very sad. Remember, this was his favorite wife. Not Leah, not the maidservants, and now she's gone, and he changed the name for some reason or another to, instead of the child of labor, now the child of my right hand. And of course, that little child, he didn't blame him for Rachel's death. He was, in a way, the special child. Remember that as we go later in Genesis about little Benjamin. That's how you pronounce it in Hebrew. Where'd all this take place? Look at verse 19. Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. Luz became Bethel, Ephrath became Bethlehem. Would you be able to tell me the two places in the Bible where this is mentioned? Let me show them to you. Turn to the book of Micah, chapter 5, prediction of the coming of Messiah. Chapter 5, verse 2. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you were little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come to me the one who is to be ruler of Israel, whose goings forth are from old and from everlasting. Now, it's called Bethlehem Ephrathah because there were two Bethlehems at this time. Now, this was hundreds of years later, so it says it's Bethlehem, but also the one that was once known as Ephrathah. Would you have known Micah 5, 2. Would you have known Matthew 2? I bet you knew that one, so turn to Matthew 2. A star led the wise men to Israel, new king to be born. Star disappeared. They go to Jerusalem, go to the king. He didn't know where there's going to be a new baby. Calls in his wise men, the scribes. And they say, where is this Messiah to be born? Verse 5, in Bethlehem of Judea. Not the other Bethlehem, but this Bethlehem. For thus it is written by the prophet, and then he quotes Micah 5, 2. And very interesting, it goes on to mention, look down to verse 18, after Herod's soldiers had killed so many people in that village, it says, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted. That's very mysterious. It's almost like Rachel, who had died almost 2,000 years earlier, is somehow in heaven weeping for her descendants. These are all these little children that Herod's soldiers had killed there in Bethlehem. Go back to Genesis. So after she passed away, and I'm sure Jacob went into mourning here, and he set up a pillar on the grave, verse 20, just like a pillar of rededication. Now a gravestone, which is there to this day. Evidently, when Moses wrote this, he had been there and knew about this hundreds of years later. You know, sometimes a tombstone and other markers last a long time. You've heard me mention the Daniel Ranch down in Texas, and on a certain little place, there's a half a dozen little tombstones, and the rain and wind have washed away all the markings. But we found out those go back to about, 1880 or so, some of the first pioneers. And so the tombstone here lasted for centuries, we're told. Now we turn to something very sad and embarrassing, 21 to 26. Israel journeyed, pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. It happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben, the oldest son, went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard about this. Now, this had been a few years since they'd come back to Israel, back to the Promised Land. And now Reuben is a young man. He's the oldest son. And for various reasons, he says here, he lay with her. That's a euphemism for sexual relations, just like going into the various Hebrew ways of saying this. But he wasn't married to her, and she wasn't married. But notice who this was. It was Bilhah. She was old enough to be his mother because she was the mother of some of his brothers. And so was this, as some scholars say, to assert his rights as the oldest son? I am in charge and I am now a man. Or is this a rite of passage? No, it's what the Bible calls fornication. And it was wrong, but she went along with this for some reason. But is he trying to have children of his own? Why didn't he get married? But in any case, Israel, not Jacob, Israel heard about this, and he was very grieved. Chapter concludes 23 to 26. This section concludes with, again, a list of all the different sons and with their mothers. Could you name all these sons, including little Benjamin? For bonus points, could you name their mothers? A lot of Jewish people for hundreds of years, little children said, give me a hard question. Of course I can name the 12 tribes and those mothers, Leah, Zilpah, they could name them all. Well, here it does name them. Leah was first. She had six boys plus a girl, Dinah, and she had more than all the others. Rachel had two, Joseph and Benjamin. Bilhah, Rachel's servant, had two, and Zilpah, Leah's servant, had two. And you put them all together and you find God kept his promise from verse 11 to multiply them, and the family has grown. And as we read the book of rest of Genesis, they were no more, but these would then, as they grew up, they got married and they also had big families, so that within a few hundred years they numbered hundreds of thousands. God kept his promise. And so the names are listed here. The last section, 27 to 29, the death of Isaac. This would be at least 20 years since Jacob fled for his life, probably closer to 30 years. Now he's back, and he's met up with Isaac. We're not told that he met with Rebekah. Perhaps he did. But imagine what it was like after all these years. He had expected Isaac to have died, because remember when Isaac, 20 or something years earlier, was dim and said, I'm about to die, so get my sons in here so that I might bless the oldest. And he expected to die. Well, he lived at least another 20 years. God gives us more or less years than we expect. It's, our lives are in his hand. But again, you have to read between the lines. He met up with Isaac. Jacob met up with Isaac. It would have been a happy reunion. Have you ever been separated from a parent for many years? I studied overseas for 7 years. I still remember July 1983 when I came home, landed on the tarmac of the airport in San Antonio and came on there with my father and mother I hadn't seen for 7 years. Boy, I ran and hugged them, and we all wept happy tears. I'm sure that Jacob did as well, just like he did with Esau when they were reconciled. But it wouldn't last long. Verse 28, Isaac, now very old. Would you know how old he is? 180. That's pretty old. You say, how come we don't have people that old today? Well, they lived much older than that before the flood, but after the flood, shorter and shorter. And so for most of history since then, people live 70s, 80s, occasionally get over 100, but nothing like 180. And he didn't die earlier, after all, as he thought he would. And so he, it says, Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, that is Hebron. Abraham and Isaac had dwelt there. Remember, there was a family burial plot, but he buried Rachel elsewhere because it wasn't nearby. Days of Isaac were 180 years. Isaac breathed his last and died, was gathered to his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. He finally died after all those. Just think about, we're not told as much about him as about Abraham, but this was the one that carried the wood up to the top and was about to be sacrificed. He was the one that couldn't see, and Jacob cheated him with the hands and the hair. And now he passes away, and we're told here something very tender. It says his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. They had been reconciled, and now they show up, and I'm sure they said, well, where are we going to do? Okay, Jacob, you can do this. And Esau says, yeah, and I'll do this. It's our duty. A son needs to step forward and say, I will show respect to my father, my mother, even when they die. And this would have been very moving. I'm sure they wept together. Five lessons. Number one, like Jacob, let us rededicate ourselves to God. He's going back to Bethel where he had previously dedicated himself. Now he's rededicating ourselves. We need to do that. Some people do that when they go back to the exact place where they were converted. You're looking at one. I was converted in New Orleans May 10th, 1972 at a certain place, and it's etched forever in my mind. And I've been back to New Orleans a few times since then. Every time I do, I go late at night to that same place because I was saved in the middle of the night. And I go there and say, yeah, that same tree is there. And I usually have a few tears, the happy memories. The great George Whitefield once wrote in his diary that he says, whenever I am back in Oxford, I can't help running to the place where I first met the Lord. I wonder if the Apostle Paul, whenever he went through Damascus, ever went back to that same place in the road and said, yep, right there is where I fell down, and then let's go into a certain street called Straight, and that's where Ananias met with me. Perhaps. Maybe you remember the exact place. Some people don't, but if you remember the exact place, how do you feel when you go back there? Well, you should rededicate yourself. And it says here, he built an altar. Now, we don't necessarily have to rebuild an altar, but it's the idea of rededication and renew your vow. For example, remember your baptism. That's something we should never forget. And Romans 12:1 says, dedicate your bodies as a living sacrifice. So we don't have an actual altar with an animal, but we should dedicate ourselves. And like Jacob said to his family, let's put away the idols. We need to put away the idols. Anything left over from our pre-Christian life that is not pleasing to God, have do with. The book of 1 John ends with, little children, beware of idols. So should we. Notice Jacob took the lead with his family to them. You got any idols? Throw them away. We're going to bury them over there. I bet he went over to Rachel and says, now, honey, I know you still have your daddy's idols. It's time to ditch them, even though it had been years since then. Never too late. It's like the old hymn, Trust and Obey, says, until all on the altar we lay. And that's what we do when we rededicate ourselves. We should rededicate ourselves not just every day and on certain days, but at communion. I think that's a good time to say, Lord, I am yours again. And then also on our annual spiritual birthday. Mine was on Friday. And I did a lot of thinking back to that day and saying, yeah, Lord, thank you for saving me then and there. And I rededicate myself to you today. Lesson number two, God changes our identity when we become Christians. He gave a new name to Jacob, just like he changed the name of Abraham, Sarah, Peter, Paul, and other ones in the Bible. He also changed the name of Luz to Bethel and Ephratah to Bethlehem. God changes our identity, not necessarily our name, but our identity. It says in the book of Revelation, I will give you a new name. And it's just like a woman takes on the name of her husband when she gets married. We are married to Christ. Our identity is no longer, well, I'm an American. I'm a male. I'm of such and such a race, such and such a background. This is my job. Those are all true, but our real identity is I belong to Jesus. What's that hymn? Now I belong to Jesus. We do. Book of James says, by that noble name by which you are called. We are a Christian. We are a follower of Christ. That's, in a way, a badge of honor as well as identity, our true identity. Number three, we shall all die. Jacob lost three very close loved ones in this one chapter. Deborah, that helped raise him, Rachel, his beloved wife, and Isaac, his father. This reminds us that we too will die, and we will also go through the valley of mourning, losing people. Parents, grandparents, says here, his wife, his father. So we know what that's like. It's happened to others, and we grow up fearing the day when our parents will die, but we gradually realize it's going to happen. What's going to happen to us? All of us here will die unless we live to see the second coming of Christ and go to heaven without dying. But in all likelihood, we will all die. Notice verse 18 in particular when Rachel was dying. Very important thing. As her soul was departing, for she died. That's the essence of what death is. You've heard me preach on this. We have a soul inside the body. And what death really is when the soul leaves the body. Not these out-of-body experience myths, but the soul leaves the body, goes into the next life, and the body stops operating. Heart stops beating, brain waves stop, cells stop reproducing, internal organs stop, the heart, the mind, they all stop, but the soul goes on into the next life. That's the essence of death. And the Bible tells us that, Ecclesiastes 12, then the soul will return to God, and the body returns to the earth. James 2, the body without the soul is dead. When Jesus died, he says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. He breathed his last, and he died. Parents need to teach their children what death is. They'll see things on television. Mom, is that really what happened, or what happened to Grandma? Parents need to sit down with the children at various stages of life and say, death is reality. All that lives will die, and this is what happened to Grandma. And well, it's not like what you saw on television the other day. They need to tell them the truth, and very honestly. One thing that happens is we stop breathing. Look at verse 29. Isaac breathed his last. When our soul leaves the body, our lungs stop operating. They may be hooked up to an artificial lung in rare cases, but other organs stop operating. The soul is gone and the body now ceases to function. Something else in verse 29, he was gathered to his people. Which people? Abraham and his mother Sarah and other believers. This tells us that not like the Chinese that are meeting up with their ancestors, but that there will be reunion of believers in heaven. Not everybody goes there, but there are people there. I bet everybody here can name someone you're looking forward to seeing in heaven. I want to see my mother. I want to see my father. I want to see my grandma Staggs. I did her funeral back in January 1986. Think of people you want to see again. In fact, when I've talked to Christians, and I said, what do you look forward to in heaven? And the top 10 things they name is, I want to see such and such. Sometimes they say, I want to see my little child that died, stillbirth, or something like that. Or I want to meet the person that witnessed to me. He's my spiritual father. He's in heaven now. And so we should look forward to this, being gathered to his people. Let me throw this in, because this isn't a coincidence. It mentions three deaths, and each time it says they were buried. I've said that earlier in this series. God's normal pattern is burial, not cremation. I've never officiated a cremation. I wouldn't turn it down, but when a family asks me, I say, let's follow the examples in the Bible as much as possible. We find three here. John the Baptist's headless body was buried, and our Lord Jesus was buried. So the general pattern is burial, not cremation. Cremation came from the pagans, but sometimes Christians don't look into enough and say it's a lot cheaper. But if they ask our opinion, say, well, let's look into burial. Something else we can learn about these that died. We find one middle-aged, Rachel, the two very elderly, which tells us that we might die at any age. I think everybody here except those little girls can name someone that died younger than us. Heard the story just this last week. Steve Andrus said someone he knew over there in Manchester that was younger than him by 10 years died suddenly. Now, Steve is on the other side of 60, but we've all known people that die younger than us. When I was a boy, my 12-year-old cousin died of leukemia. So we know people younger than us, older than us. Rachel was middle-aged, but Deborah and Isaac were much older. Number four, and I won't elaborate it, but Reuben's bad example. Fornication is wrong. There's no excuse for that. Just like no excuse for what Shechem had done with Dinah. This came back to haunt Reuben many years later when Jacob was on his deathbed, Genesis 49, 3 and 4, and Reuben was probably thinking, I'm the oldest, I'm going to get the birthright and the great blessing, just like Jacob got it away from his brother. Here I am, Daddy. And Jacob says, you're not getting the blessing. Because of this incident many, many years earlier, look it up. And I'm sure if Reuben was thinking, I was dumb to throw it away just like Uncle Esau had sold his birthright. How could I be so dumb? Who got the birthright? He said, well, the birth order then. What about Levi and Simeon? Nope, they didn't get it either because of what they did, murdering all the people in Shechem. And Jacob remembered that. Looked that up in Genesis 4. And so it went down to son number four. And who was that? Judah. My point is that there are consequences to our sin. And this wasn't a rite of passage, as some people say. There's no excuse for it, even though it's common today. And yet there is forgiveness. Here's another sub-lesson. Fathers should teach their sons not just about what sex is and what it's for, but to warn them about immorality. Just read the book of Proverbs and notice how often the father says, my son, look out for this, and the mother warning the daughters. Lesson number five, last one for tonight, God confirms his covenant with us, just like he confirmed his covenant with Jacob, verses 11 to 12, repeating the covenant to Abraham, to Isaac, now to Jacob. That covenant has been fulfilled, so it's not like he confirms this covenant to us. Land hadn't been given to us, a promise of many children hadn't been given to us. We're in the new covenant. But God confirms it and asks us to remember it and rededicate ourselves. How? How about it? Communion. Communion, this is the new covenant in my blood. God kept the covenant. We should rededicate ourselves regularly at communion to keeping the new covenant by saying, I continue to believe, I continue to repent, I'm going to follow Jesus. But we do communion by remembering God has kept his covenant and always will. Never forget that. And that's why God kept reminding Jacob and the Israelites for centuries after this. I kept my covenant, you haven't. May it be said of us that we keep his commandment. Those are our five lessons. Do we have any questions on tonight's chapter? Yes, please do.
Back earlier in the record of Jacob, you mentioned a couple of weeks ago that as Jacob grows spiritually, he becomes wiser. The Lord teaches him. Mm. And his first experience at Bethel, when he saw the angels ascending into heaven and so forth, he said, surely this is the house of God. But now, after time has passed, in verse 7, he recognizes that it's not just the house, but it is the God.
It's not just the house of God, but it's the God of the house. That's a mark of maturity, right? Is that the comment you wanted to make? That's a good one. We're proud of you. I bet you're proud of your wife. Yes. Good insight. We should go and do likewise. Do we have any other little observations, applications, questions?
I think it's amazing to see how God puts up with our immaturity.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've heard people say, oh, Peter, he's always putting his foot in his mouth doing, but he meant well, but Christ was patient with him. When we look at Jacob, we should say, I am Jacob. We're not perfect and we make blunders like he did, but I think his heart was in the right place and he was growing and learning lessons. So do we. Good observation. Anyone else? Brendan, how about you, our seminary student? We've been doing this series on Genesis, as you remember, and we get 5 lessons. Have they taught you how to pull spiritual lessons out of a narrative passage? You know, it's easy to go through Paul or the Ten Commandments and get applications, but to look at a story and say, now, how does that apply to us today? Could you get 5 lessons? It was hard last week. Boy, was it ever. There was no good example, but we can learn from a bad example. But I've given you 5 lessons and applications. You'll learn how to do that.
Tom Whitney mentioned this text as a support for the fathers leading their families in worship.
Yes. And leading them in rededication, leading them in tossing out the idols. That's a good one. Say hi to Don Whitney for me. If there are no others, let's pray and then we'll sing. Father, thank you that you confirmed your promise to Jacob and his family and you kept it by multiplying them and giving them the land and protecting them. Confirm your promises to us, the promise of the new covenant, forgiveness of sins, and other promises like you will never leave us or forsake us, you will keep us to the end. You will protect us from all evil and many other precious promises. In Jesus' name, amen.